Is the system for how Iowa cares for its juvenile delinquents adequate? Where could the state improve? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. Recent controversy around the Iowa Juvenile Home has sparked a conversation about how we treat our juvenile delinquents. Governor Terry Branstad ordered the closure of the home after it was discovered some girls there were being held in isolation cells. Everyone seems to agree on one thing: something needs to change. Join our conversation after the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. After an investigation last year discovered that some teenage girl residents at the Iowa Juvenile Home in Toledo were being held in isolation cells, Governor Terry Branstad ordered its closure. The home was closed, and four Democratic lawmakers sued Governor Branstad, saying that he was working outside his executive power by closing the home. A Polk County District Court judge sided with the lawmakers. The governor has appealed. And while the issue continues to work through the courts, there's still an urgency to get something done. With me here for the first part of River to River is Jerry Foxhoven. He's the executive director of clinical programs at Drake University Law School. He chaired the governor's Juvenile Home Protection Task Force and has been a child advocate for 35 years. Jerry, welcome to River to River.
Thanks, Clay. Nice to be here.
So first tell me, why did Toledo close, and did it match what the recommendations were from the task force?
Well, the task force didn't recommend closure, although the closure is not a surprise based upon the recommendations of the task force. We made a number of recommendations. One was that boys and girls shouldn't both be there. It should only be girls. The second is that we shouldn't combine both child in need of assistance girls and delinquent girls, and that would take those out of there. And then we said, among other things, someone would have to make a determination whether it's feasible to keep that institution going with the number of girls that were left. In the last 3 years, the highest count of girls in a girl training school, it was 15 in a month. On average, it's 10 or 11. This is a 27-acre campus with a lot of buildings. The cottages certainly are out of date, as we said in the report. And so it didn't, I think, surprise any of us that it got closed, because based upon the implementation of the other recommendations, it left so few girls that there was a question of whether it was feasible to maintain it.
So first of all, what's the difference between a child in need of assistance versus a delinquent girl?
Well, the simplest way to say it is that child in need of assistance are kids who have either some needs, or they're basically victims, or they have needs. So they've either been abused or neglected by their parents, or they have mental health needs or other needs that can't be met by their family, that the state has to intervene and meet those needs. They're not kids who have necessarily broken the law. Now, their mental health may cause them to do some things that violate the law. But delinquent girls are girls who committed an offense that, if they were over the age of 18, would be a crime.
And so there's also a facility for delinquent boys specifically provided for in the Iowa law in Eldora, but not for girls. Why is that?
Well, actually, there were for both. The Eldora facility houses about 114 boys. There are a lot more boys that qualify and are appropriate for training school than girls, for a lot of reasons: the types of offenses that boys do versus girls and the safety risks. A long time ago, the girls' state training school was at Mitchellville, where the woman's prison is. I think people have said, rightfully so, that doesn't make a lot of sense. They needed the beds anyway, and putting girls with older women who are criminals doesn't make a lot of sense either. And so at one point, they moved them over to Toledo. And Toledo kind of became the, if we don't know where else to put kids, this is where we put them, is in Toledo, which is part of the problem, too. There wasn't a really clear, defined mission at Toledo. And so That became the girls' state training school, in addition to basically a what we call a PMIC, a psychiatric mental institution for children, as well as some kind of group home. It kind of had a real mix of kids, most of whom had significant mental health issues.
So boys and girls shouldn't be held to the same standards?
No, they should be held to the same standards. They just shouldn't be, number one, put together. It is not economically feasible to put them together because you got to keep them apart. Secondly, the treatment modalities are completely different between girls and boys. And so that didn't make any sense. And so we had a facility for boys and a facility for girls that had a mix that was not appropriate.
And what describe the differences between the treatment modality for boys versus girls?
Well, again, you'll get some people, a lot more boys that are just plain antisocial. They're just criminal behavior. We don't get that as much with girls for the most part. With girls, oftentimes their behavior is because of dependency, for instance, on males, where they're joining in with them on a crime. And so we would want to treat their dependency on that male person rather than just treat them as a criminal. Also, the types of crime they commit are substantially different. They're not generally as often involved in gang activity or stabbing type of activity and so forth. And so, and the whole science of treatment of kids basically says there needs to be gender-specific treatment that is specific for girls and specific for boys. Unfortunately, you know, we haven't been able to do that with the mix that we had there in the past.
From the time when the Disability Rights Iowa group released the information, discovered that there was girls being held in isolation cells, we started to hear the buzz about it. How quickly was the task force put together, and then how quickly did you come up with your recommendations?
Really, we were given a very, very short timeline. The governor appointed us, I think, on August 20th of this last year and directed us at that time to get right on it and to get a report back by October 15th. So you're talking a very short period of time, less than 2 months. We met a lot, did a lot of work in a very short period of time. Every one of our meetings took virtually a whole day. We heard testimony from a lot of people, looked at a lot of reports and so forth. But we zeroed in, and I think very quickly, because the governor wanted really some decisions made very quickly because of the situation with the girls being there and because we needed to know what to do, how to move forward real quickly.
So lay out those recommendations. What did you bring forth?
Well, we did a number of things. The first thing we said was that, again, boys and girls shouldn't be mixed there. There weren't very many boys there. I think at the time there were only about four boys there. So that was kind of an easy thing to say, let's resolve that. Second thing, we needed to look at taking China girls away from the delinquent girls. And the obvious question from that is, where do they go then? Where do these girls go? In the past, if a girl had failed other placements, private placements, that was kind of the end of the road. Toledo was the end of the road. So you'd failed other placements, didn't find another place for you. In some ways, I hate to refer to it this way, but it was looked at like a dumping ground. These are the girls that couldn't make it anyplace else. It was the place of last resort. And so this task force had to look at what would we do instead of having a placement of last resort. And DHS, for the purposes primarily of trying to stop out-of-state placements, had entered into a contract, an agreement with one private provider, Four Oaks, that they did through Magellan, which is kind of the HMO for state federal funding of health care. And they basically worked out a policy with Four Oaks saying, we will give you more money, but you have to have a no-reject, no-eject policy with the kids we send to you. So if we send you a kid, you can't say, this kid's too difficult for us. You're going to take them. And then you're going to say, we're going to keep them until they age out or their situations resolve so they can go home. And that was more expensive, obviously, to do, but it was much more effective, and they were able to keep those kids. And so the task force said, we should enter into those kind of contracts for all of these kids so there isn't a placement of last resort, but that's, in effect, their first placement is also their last placement. They'll get continuity of care. We then said you need to move all of the isolation rooms out of the centralized administration building. And if you have those type of isolation rooms, they should be in the cottages. That's kind of the state of the art today because that's how you avoid overuse of them. And so we said that should be done. We also said DHS should not be operating the school there. And I think most task force members would probably say DHS shouldn't be operating the school at any of its institutions. It should be operated by either the AEA or the local school district rather than DHS. They're not in the education business. That's the bulk of the recommendations that we made.
And when you said age out, that means when they turn 18? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, when they reach 18. The other thing that we did recommend is that something be done to provide some services to kids when they left a place like Toledo. In other group home settings and so forth, the other settings that we have in the state, if a kid leaves that setting, age, what we call ages out, we have all kinds of programs that we can offer for them. I mean, we never used to, but now we do because we know these kids need continued services. Their mental health issues don't just go away when they hit their 18th birthday. And so we provide those kind of services to them when they age out, usually till about age 21. We weren't doing that with the kids in Toledo. So on their 18th birthday, it was goodbye. Really, the day before their 18th birthday, they were sent out and they received no further services. And so we recommended that just should not happen. And it didn't happen in private facilities. It was happening here, and we recommended that that stop.
And I should clarify something I said earlier, that it's not just that these residents were being held in isolation cells, but that they were being held in those cells for an extended period of time, and that in that time they weren't able to have access to education and services.
Correct. The problem with the isolation cells is that the law is really different for delinquent girls than for China girls. I mean, it's one thing when you have someone who's broken the law and they've not been able to do probation in the past and they consider to be unsafe. What you can do to that kind of person is entirely different from what you can do to someone who is not there because they broke the law. The example I would give you is with an adult. We would have no question that you could treat people in Fort Madison prison differently than you could treat somebody in a mental institution. Because of the different reasons why they're there. And so the mixture of China girls and delinquent girls created a lot of confusion. And even for delinquent girls, it was very much overused.
And again, when we're using this term China girls, we're talking about children in need of assistance.
Correct. Ones that did not break the law. They weren't there because they broke the law.
So what kind of education services were being provided to them under the care of the state?
Well, they operated a school there, a regular school there. And the Department of Education, right at the very end of the meetings of the task force, had released a report about the really malfunctioning of the school that was there. And there were a number of issues. One of the issues, though, was that education was being treated as a right that you had to earn. And we wouldn't allow parents to do that. I mean, we have a compulsory education school. We'd file truancy charges against a parent who did that. And yet here at Toledo, we were saying you had to earn the right to go to school. And imagine, I think the one girl that DRI identified had been in seclusion for 11 months. She'd been 11 months without school, that she'd been locked up in a little room or kept in a little room. And so that just is not appropriate. The Department of Education had ordered that the state make remedial benefits to those girls for the last 2 years that got out of Toledo. The governor's included, I think, about $1 million in his budget for that. I'm not sure anybody quite knows what that's going to entail because nobody knows. But we did fail those girls, and we have for some period of time, and the Department of Education says we need to make it up to them.
So what changes in state laws are needed to address this?
Well, I think it's going to be a process. The one thing I think we do know is that most would probably be in agreement that DHS ought to get out of the education business in their institutions. And so we're still there in Eldora. And I think we need to explore how do we get out of that. There are lots of funding issues with that. These kids come from all over the state. If we ask a local school district or the AEA to run that school, you know, it's not fair to the school district in Eldora to say you get to fund 114 kids' education. It wouldn't have been fair in Toledo to say there were 20-some girls there that Toledo school district has to come up with 20-some with education for 20-some kids. On the other hand, probably even the funding that local school district had, if you said that local school district, if their kid goes there, they can give that money to them, probably isn't enough because these kids have really very, very special needs. And we do lose economies of scale. If you're talking about 12 delinquent girls, operating a school for 12 girls, we've known in Iowa that that doesn't work very well. That's why we consolidated school districts, because it's a very expensive proposition. So it is one of those good news and bad news. The good news is we don't lock up very many girls, and that's really good. The bad news is we lose economies of scale, and it's going to cost more to do that. And the other difficult thing is that those kids don't come in at semester time. You know, kids who get arrested for a dangerous crime, it's when they get arrested. So we need school that can, that is always available, where they can come in at any time and be, and be, get a good education.
So if you were king of the world and could completely remake this system, what would it look like?
Well, in a perfect world, we would take the money that we're spending on, that we spent on those girls in Toledo, and try to wrap enough services around them that we wouldn't even need to lock them up. Whether that's feasible or not, I don't know. We had very few girls.
Because we're talking about 14, yeah, when it was closed down.
Yeah, yeah. And some of those went directly home when they closed. And so they were ready to get out of there anyway. And so I think it's the first thing we could look at is, do we really need to lock – how many do we need to lock up, and do we need to lock up any? In a perfect world, I'd say, no, let's not lock up any. Let's provide services, and we'll keep them out of – we're not in a perfect world, and there are probably some girls that are going to have to be locked up. The question is getting that sweet spot, that number. And I think most of us would say we don't want more beds than we need, because if you build them, they'll fill them. And we don't want more kids locked up. We want to try to wrap all the services we can around those kids. And when they get out, if we wrap services around them, we can probably prevent them from getting back in or going to prison when they're adults.
Would the public be comfortable with that?
Well, I hope so. You know, again, girls are different than boys. And so some of the boys that we have in – that's why we have 114 in Eldora as opposed to 12 or 14 in Toledo. They're a different kind of kid. And so a lot of the boys, the public probably wouldn't be comfortable with some of those kids that are at the boys' state training school being back in their community right now. On the other hand, a lot of the girls probably aren't as dangerous. There certainly aren't as many, and maybe not.
So why are they – I mean, it might be common knowledge, but why are they treated differently than adults?
Well, because kids – and even now, more recently, the United States Supreme Court has even said that. Kids are different. We have all – unless you're a lot better person than I am, you did some stupid things when you were kids that you would never do today, and that you probably wouldn't even want to admit to your kids that you did. And if somebody would have seen it, they'd have said it was criminal. You could have been arrested for it. So – kids have bad judgment. They're more influenced by their peers than adults are, hopefully. And they just make bad decisions sometimes. And that can be changed a little better. They grow, and we all get more mature, and so we change. So most of the time we're not as dangerous, but also we're certainly more salvageable, because we can teach kids about what happens when you make poor decisions, or when you follow your peers rather than what you know is right.
And we've hinted at it. We haven't really explained it, but the difference between the crimes that are, say, committed by a boy or a girl.
You know, the most common crime for a girl is shoplifting. And I think very few people would think we ought to send a kid to training school for shoplifting. Another fairly common crime for girls is prostitution. And at least most of us child advocates would say a girl who's under the age of 18 that is prostituting herself is probably a victim, not a criminal. She is either homeless or has no way of supporting herself, or she is being victimized by an adult or by somebody else. And so a few of us would think that's the kind of person that we would want to lock up in a secure facility. Boys, we have gang members, we have people who have done stuff with guns, have robbed people with a gun, shot somebody, stabbed somebody. And they're not all that way, but more serious drug offenses and so forth. Not generally that they were just doing something, following along with somebody they were with. Certainly with girls, a lot of times they were with a male who did something that was bad, and they were with them more than anything else.
And when you were saying to wrap services around these kids, what kinds of services are we talking about?
Literally, most of these, pretty well all of the girls that were at Toledo, all of the girls in the girls' training school have some mental health issues. And so those just don't go away when we lock them up. They need services when they're in there, and they don't go away when we release them. If anybody who has a family member that has struggled with mental illness knows that it's a lifetime thing that they're going to struggle with. And so we need to help give them services to try to deal with that, and to know that they have resources when they get out there, and so that they can connect with the proper resources so they can get on with their life and get job skills. They are also typically well behind in terms of education. So they've got some catching up to do, which means that they'll have trouble getting jobs if they don't. And so we need to help them with that, get the educational skills they need and some training that they need. Probably wherever that training school would be for girls, we would probably need to somehow connect up with community colleges to help them get their GEDs if necessary, job training, or other skills in things like nursing and so forth so that they can have a decent career when they get going.
And how effective are those services in Iowa right now?
Well, you know, I will say this. When I said earlier it's a good news, bad news thing, obviously they're pretty effective because we hardly have any girls that we lock up. And that's not because they're not committing offenses. It's because our juvenile court officers in juvenile court services have worked real hard to get services to kids when they first get involved with the law, with breaking the law, to say, is there a way we can get these kids back on the right path? So normally, the first time they commit a crime, or at least a serious crime, we figure they've come to a fork in the road, and we could either get them to kind of move over to the other fork, which is law-abiding and get their act together, or if we don't, they're going to end up in Mitchellville if they're a girl, or in Fort Madison or Anamosa if they're a boy. So that's a great time to intervene, and I think we do a good job of that, and that's reflected by the few numbers that we have for girls, but also, frankly, for boys. That number is not too bad for the whole state to have 114 kids in Eldora.
Will the state's new mental health system serve – would it serve these girls or will it serve these girls?
It will certainly help some. I mean, we know now that even just with health care reform, even on the federal level, they'll be able to get health care to a longer age now. And so that's going to help a lot. I think everybody involved in this decision-making process here, from legislators on both sides of the aisle to the governor's office, all believe we need to give kids services when they get out of whatever institution we put them in. I like to say it's, you know, if you remember the first Blues Brothers music, you know, movie, when he got out and they just handed him a little sack with everything he had when he came in and basically booted him out the door. We don't even do that to adults now. We put them in halfway houses. We help them get jobs. We help them get training, help them build up an account so they can make a deposit for an apartment. And we're there with kids now, too, knowing that we just don't shove them out the door when they're 18.
Politics aside from everything, you said that it wasn't surprising that the governor shut down the home based on the task force's findings. Why is that?
Well, you know, we didn't have any inside information. I will tell you this, that when the governor appointed me to this task force and asked me to chair it, I said to him, what are you looking at here? Wanting to know, is there some agenda, you know? Because the governor's an elected office, and so you always think that that's what you have to look at. And he literally said, you know, I have no agenda here. All I want to know is what's best for these girls. Just tell me what's best for these girls. And so how could you say no to that, to chair that task force? Then we were through with the conversation. He said, oh, one more thing. And I said, oh, okay, here it comes. And he said, and this is not about money. It's about what's best for girls. Just look at what's best for these girls. And so we were able to do that and stay out of the politics of it and just look at what is best for the girls. And that's what really guided our recommendations.
We're going to bring in a couple lawmakers in the second part of the show. How do you feel the discussion is going in the legislature?
You know, I think we're moving in a very positive direction. There is a bill right now that's pending, and it needs a lot. It needs some tweaking yet, but it's gotten a lot of tweaking already that has moved it much, much closer to where it needs to be. So I think we are rapidly moving to the point where we will have something that the legislature will pass that will provide, you know, a girls' state training school that will be small, that will have wraparound services when they get out. We'll have a school operated by the local AEA or the local school district. And I think we're going to get there. There are obviously some small issues that both sides are going to fight about, but we'll get there.
Okay, Jerry Foxhoven, we're going to continue this conversation. You're the Executive Director of Clinical Programs at Drake University Law School and chaired the Governor's Juvenile Home Protection Task Force. He's going to stay with us, and we'll also bring Democratic Senator Liz Mathis of Cedar Rapids and Republican Representative Dave Heaton of Mount Pleasant into the conversation. It's River to River on Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Clay Masters. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Clay Masters. Good afternoon. After an investigation last year discovered that some teenage girl residents at the Iowa Juvenile Home in Toledo were being held in isolation cells for long periods of time, Governor Terry Branstad ordered its closure. The home was closed. Four Democratic lawmakers sued the governor. Branstad says that the lawmakers were alleging that he was working outside his executive power by closing the home. It's working its way through the courts, but we're having a discussion about how we treat our juvenile delinquents in the state. We've been talking with Jerry Foxhoven. He's the executive director of clinical programs at Drake University Law School and chaired the governor's Juvenile Home Protection Task Force. He's with us for the second half. And we're also bringing into the conversation State Senator Liz Mathis, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids. She's here with me as well in the State House Law Library. She's also the chief community officer at Four Oaks, a nonprofit child welfare, juvenile justice, and behavioral agency. Senator Mathis, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Clay.
So, first of all, Senator Mathis, do you think a secure facility is needed first, or as you heard Jerry in the first part of the show suggest, they might be able to wrap services around girls and not lock them up?
You know, actually, I think a state facility is needed because there are only so many things that private providers can do. And I believe that there is a place that delinquent girls should go, and I believe the state should be in charge of that.
Also need to mention here, too, that Representative Dave Heaton is in the room. he's here to talk a little bit with us about it, too. He's a Republican from Mount Pleasant and the chair of the House Health and Human Services Appropriations Subcommittee. Representative Heaton, welcome back to River to River.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me today, and I apologize for being late, but get caught up in another discussion. I couldn't let it go because I was the one doing the talking. So.
I understand.
And I'm always accused of talking too much, so I guess I'm paying a price for it today. So I apologize for being here. But I want to agree with the senator. We sat in on a meeting this morning, and I'm feeling very good about the way the Senate's proceeding with this issue of delinquent girls and creating a place for them. I agree with the juvenile correctional officers. There has to be a designated place. And I just at this time feel strongly that the state needs to be responsible for that.
So what was the conversation like this morning, the meeting that you mentioned?
Well, we went through this amendment on the bill. Senator Reagan was there, and Dave Johnson was there, people on the Human Resources Committee, some of them, Sodders. And so we sat in, and they went through the amendment and went into some issues about how we'd structure the financing of the education. There's an idea there about when we come to the school funding, school aid formula, that the cost of education at, and it could, probably could be applied to Eldora also, that to these two the places for boys and for girls would be taken off the top. And so we would finance the schools from the school aid formula right off the top, and then the money then would be distributed to the school districts across the state. That seemed to get a good reception. We haven't decided yet on whether the institution is going to provide the education or whether the local school district or the AEA, that's still being discussed. But we did talk about the financing of it today. Well, I made a point that the most important part of this approach is to improve, I think, the treatment that the girls are receiving. I feel that was one of the shortcomings when the decision came down to close the institution. We have other providers across the United States that do an excellent job in providing this treatment to these most difficult boys and girls. And I bring up Boys Town of Omaha, which has an excellent school, an excellent record on dealing with the nation's most difficult youth. And perhaps we should maybe bring some of these other entities that are providing these kind of services to come to us and give us some advice on how we can do the treatment better.
Senator Mathis, We heard Jerry Foxhoven talk about not having somewhere that's just seen as a last resort. Would this be a last resort for these girls, or how do you make this a place where they can thrive and become get the services that they need?
You know, I've heard that term over and over again, last resort. There's never a last resort for a girl who's in trouble and in need. I think there were two pieces to that initial bill that were taken out. I just want to go back there for a minute. One was about assessments and placements, and that was taken out. It said something like after three placements that a child would be sent to the Iowa Juvenile Home and then assessed before the next placement. You know, that could have been 1,000 children coming through there in any given year, because many times placements, you know, are not bad things. And even if a child is placed in foster care because maybe a meth lab, you know, happened at their home, and the parents are taken to jail, and the children are placed, maybe three siblings are placed in a foster home, that's one placement. Then maybe one is acting out sexually. They're sent for assessment to a PMIC. That's the second placement. And then maybe findings are that the child was not sexually abused and sent back to the foster home. That's three placements, and that child might be 5 years old. So in the bill, it was very, very broad that said children should go to IJH for assessment. So that was taken out. It was just kind of it was something that I think was put in there so that it would generate some discussion. The second piece that Jerry cited was mixing of China and delinquent and accreditation issues surrounding that. And so I think we separated that out, made sure that delinquent was the population that we're looking at and what care is provided for them. I think Dave is right about practices from places mm-hmm. like Boys Town. Clearly, what was happening, I think, at Iowa Juvenile Home is the staff had passion to do their work, but they didn't have the guidance they needed. So they didn't have a clinical director. They didn't have someone saying, these are the new modalities. Here's a model that you should be using. If a child is in an isolation room and it isn't working, take them out of the isolation room. If it's not working, don't keep doing that. Do something else. And they didn't have clear direction or leadership in that type of practice. So I think by now opening this up, restructuring it, making sure that that whoever runs this facility, if it is the state, that they make sure that there is money behind this to train workers the way they should be trained, to do follow-up services, aftercare, to put money into aftercare, and make sure that those kids are successful by the time they reach 18.
Private services, they can't add up to what the state could do?
I don't think private providers want to be involved in this at this point. Now, you may ask some other private providers, but I think a lot of private providers are structured for China cases, and they're not structured for delinquent cases. That takes another level of training. It takes a completely different facility and different types of workers. And so, I think that if you're going to do something like this, it should be a state-run facility.
And a senator mentioning the China and having them separate, I can go with that, because with a delinquent facility, you can be able to lock those dormitories at night, which gives it a whole sense of a more security. Where when you mix the two, the federal law will not allow you to lock the facility, and that was one of the issues that we had. There were two things that I want to bring up before we move on to maybe further in your conversation. Is it was brought up in our meeting about the different placements. And as those children fail in one placement and are moved to another, we would like an assessment or a directive from that provider from which the child is moving from to put down and in the file why they failed in that placement, so that the next placement is familiar with the needs of that child and be able to make sure they can address them. Okay. The second one has to do when Senator Bochum today in our subcommittee meeting mentioned that we also need a special place for our China kids. There are China kids out there who are very, very difficult. Even though they haven't committed a crime, their issues as far as how they act out on themselves and to others are just as difficult as those who are delinquent. And so he has brought up the situation of how we should be thinking of a placement for those who are most difficult, too. We're looking perhaps at some areas of expansion like at Independence or one of our other facilities, Cherokee, who have already engaged in children's mental health issues, severe mental health issues, and maybe perhaps expand there. I'm not quite sure. That it wasn't part of – I mean, it became part of our conversation today, but we were focusing mostly on delinquents.
And again, for definition, for those that aren't familiar with the term, when we say China girls, we're talking about children in need of assistance.
That's great.
Jerry, what do you think of what you're hearing so far?
You know, they're totally on board, and that's why we're moving in the right direction, and we will get this thing resolved properly. Just a little piece of clarification. Sometimes the question is, but don't we have other facilities where we combine delinquents and Chinas? And we do. That happens sometimes. But a training school is different than other delinquent kids. A training school is when they've reached a point where we've said, you do need to be locked up in a secure facility. And so a lot of kids that are delinquent don't end up in training school. And a lot of them have other needs. And those kids, sometimes you can mix in with China kids. That's what they do at Boys Town, you know. But we don't take kids from Eldora and send them to Boys Town. They're training school kids enough, but we certainly have kids that are delinquent or Chinas that we would send to Boys Town, and that is appropriate to mix them in that setting. But I do think we're on board, and I think Representative Heaton's right on board in terms of saying for an assessment piece, it would make sense to have the provider who has just had this kid for a length of time do an assessment. And if they give a 10-day notice saying that's not a, this kid is not appropriate for our facility, they ought to be saying, and these are the services he or she needs that we can't provide. That will help the decision as to where they go from there.
And I think complicating this issue too, complicating or perhaps accepting responsibility, is that several years ago, the Department of Human Services asked legislators to accept back into the state exception to policy children. And these were children that were high-level mental health cases and sent out of state to other facilities that could handle their high level of mental health. And now there are more than 100 kids in any given year that are sent out of state. So now we're accepting, private providers are accepting those children back in and back into populations. And the state has provided for training to be able to handle the kids that have those high mental health caseloads. The issue is providers need to be ready for that child once they enter that facility. So there's a deep training, maybe 3 to 4 months of training before accepting one of those children. So right now, all throughout the state, we have family resources. We have Orchard Place, Bremwood, Quakerdale, Hillcrest, Four Oaks, Boys Town. Everybody is looking at this population of exception to policy that they're coming one at a time back into the state and deciding who will be the next provider to take this child and be able to really, really address their mental health. Will that child be able to stay a little bit longer? Yes. Will that child get more intense aftercare services? Yes. Because every child is different. And these kids show that escalation. You know, they just show that high level of mental health. So things are progressing in that area. Obviously, when you send a child out of state, that's going to cost a lot more money. And if we can do the work here in the state of Iowa, the children can be closer to home, closer to community, closer to family. It works out very well for all of us. But we all have to carry the load in that.
Well, is there funding available now, or where could it be found if there is not?
Yes, there is funding available, but agencies have to commit. They have to say, we are going to we're going to take on this responsibility. We're going to make sure that this child is maybe sometimes has a one-to-one ratio. You know, and this is 24/7 care for this one child. And even as they go into the classroom, that there's still a one-to-one ratio, that this child is not out of their sight, you know, until maybe their mental health issues de-escalate. You know, so it could be a week, it could be a month, it could be 6 months before that happens. But there is, I think the third-party provider, Magellan, is working with providers and making sure that happens case by case. And that's been a major breakthrough.
So, Representative Heaton, what would it take for agencies to have to commit? What would they have to do to be ready to make the commitment?
Well, first of all, they've got to have the personnel that are willing to engage in this level of care. If you think this is an easy deal, you're crazy. These people who work with these children are exposed to violence. We had one incident at one provider with a broken jaw already, and a broken cheekbone rather. These are very, very difficult children, and the people that work with these kids have to be very, very committed to the work that they're doing. You just can't be a child welfare provider and say, well, send me a couple of them, will you? That doesn't work. They have to have special people, and they have to have a special staff, and they have to have a commitment to take care of these kids.
What about the politics of all this? Is there a risk of closing the Iowa Juvenile Home and walking away and not doing anything that solves maybe a political problem, the place where the problems occur? It's closed. What about the political buzz that seems to be in the air around this?
I don't think that our constituents or our providers or anyone that is a partner in this would stand for that. There has to be a place for delinquent girls. There just has to be. Otherwise, you will not get good outcomes. You just won't.
I think I want to reflect a little bit on what the editorial had to say in the Sunday Register this week when they talked about this situation.
What did it say then?
Well, it said that really the governor did not make a mistake in closing the facility, that it was failing in what it was supposed to do. However, they did say that a place needed to be designated for these girls somewhere in the state to provide treatment to these girls. I guess it's it's my hope that as we move the bill, it comes out of the Senate and is sent to the House, that the governor's office might begin to consider what we're doing, and I think be willing to work with the proposal. That stance has to soften a little bit to give my caucus anyway in the House a little positive feeling to go ahead with this legislation. I don't think that we're in the House wanting to shove something down the governor and say you were wrong. No, I don't think so. But at the same time, it would be very helpful if he would begin to work with us on trying to find a solution to this issue.
Senator Mathis.
But I do think he was wrong in closing it, using his powers to close it. So therein lies the rub, right? The political rub. Did he have the right to just, in effect, close the facility? He may have seen all of the evidence from the task force and certainly said something has to be done. But before he closed it, he should have met with the legislature in determining what basis and what route we should go. So there's a line between did he have the right for closure, and the other piece all of us are focused on too is we need to bring services to these kids. And so those services still need to exist.
But if you want this issue to move forward, we need to forget all about that. Put it behind us. And then work with and come out of the Senate with a good amendment to address our situation on a place for these girls. And then I ask for some support from the governor's office in moving forward. I don't want to get into the argument of why he did it and what or where, whether it was wrong or not. the deal is, it's from now on is where we're at, not from the past.
I want to give Jerry Foxhoven a chance to respond.
You know, I'm lucky because I get to be the non-political guy.
<you know? laughs> Right, exactly.
And I'm also probably the most optimistic person I know. People think it's probably in the new DSM because it's almost diagnosable. I'm so optimistic. Whether you like what the governor did or not, whether we're upset about what was happening in Toledo or not, it generated the discussion we're having here. And we've known there's been a problem dealing with these girls for years and years and years. We've never gotten off the dime on it. And so whether he did the right thing or not, the important thing is we're fixing it now. And this wasn't being done. And so we're getting into a conversation. We're getting a bill that's going to get passed. We're going to get resolution of this. And thank God we have. And so in many ways, I'm really pleased that DRI, Disability Rights Iowa, raised this issue because it got us talking about these kids that we weren't paying attention to. We needed to pay attention to it. We're doing it now. And you hear the ideas that Representative Heaton and Senator Mathis are coming up with and saying everybody's working together and coming up with great ideas that will make this a better state for those kids. And so thank God we're doing it.
And that's where we're going to have to wind down our conversation here. Thanks so much to my guests, Jerry Foxhoven, the Executive Director of Clinical Programs at Drake University Law School, who chaired the Governor's Juvenile Home Protection Task Force, to State Senator Liz Mathis, a Democrat from Cedar Rapids, also Chief Community Officer at Four Oaks, a nonprofit child welfare, juvenile justice, and behavioral agency, and to Representative Dave Heaton, a Republican from Mount Pleasant and the chair of the House Health and Human Services Appropriations Subcommittee. Thank you to all of you for being here today.
Thanks, Clay.
River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from John Pimble. We always welcome your comments and questions about the program, River to River, at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Clay Masters. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.